Yeah, the Galatians were a Celtic tribe, actually, that had migrated from Central Europe down into that part of Turkey about 300 years before Paul wrote. And they had eventually been Romanized by the Romans after being conquered by them, and Paul is writing to them. You know, it's interesting, the major issue in the letter to the Galatians, if you read it as a whole, and there are 6 chapters, and it's not a really long letter, it's an interesting letter, is whether Gentiles, that is non-Jews, there were Jews, in Jewish understanding, there are Jews and there are non-Jews. And everybody who's not a Jew is a non-Jew, and they're called Gentiles. And the question was whether, in order to follow Jesus, you had to become a Jew first. Do non-Jews need to take upon themselves the obligations of being Jewish in order to accept Jesus as their Lord and Savior? And it's a natural question to ask, especially in that first century of the church. Things were just getting going, and of course, Jesus was Jewish. He was born to Jewish parents. He was a practicing Jew his whole life. Claimed to be the Messiah of the Jewish people, the anointed one of God. That's what it means to be Messiah, anointed one of God. Jesus said on several occasions that he came to redeem the people of Israel. Spent most of his time ministering and preaching to Jewish people. Called together a group of Jewish disciples, followers, journeyed to Jerusalem, the Jewish major city, for major Jewish festivals. He got caught up in the messianic fervor of one Passover feast, was brought before the Jewish High Council, charged with blasphemy and threats against the temple. Was convicted by this Jewish High Council and handed over to the Roman authorities as a terrorist insurrectionist. He was crucified as the failed king of the Jews. When Jesus was raised from the dead, he revealed himself to his Jewish followers. And all the new disciples that came out of this wave of evangelism that arose from his resurrection were themselves Jewish. In the book of Acts, it talks about several thousand people coming to faith in the preaching of those first disciples right after the resurrection. They were all Jewish. Christianity started off as another Jewish sect alongside the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Essenes, the Zealots. Even John the Baptist still had a community of disciples at the time. One of the great debates within Judaism of the time of Jesus and a couple of hundred years before that was, what was God going to do with the Gentiles, the non-Jews? And therefore, what should they do with the Gentiles, the non-Jews? And there was one school of thought that believed that God would ultimately rid the world of these reprobate Jews. Non-Jews, I should say. That God would get rid of all the non-Jews. All these godless, corrupted human beings that were unreformable. And this meant that the Jewish task was to look inward, remain detached from the Gentile world, to stand apart from it, to be removed from it. But there was another school of thought within this Judaism of the times that God would welcome the Gentiles back into the family, so to speak. When God's final plans were unfolding, God would welcome home all Gentile peoples. And we get an example of this in the Old Testament, found in Isaiah 2. I've got it up there on a slide. It's what it says here in Isaiah 2. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Catch that, all nations. Many people will come. Many peoples will come. Many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. All nations, many peoples. In this understanding, the God of the Jewish, or the God of Jacob, the God of the Jewish people, would become the center point for the peoples all over the world. And that meant that the Jewish instinct was to turn outward to the world, to that non-Jewish world. In fact, Israel had a purpose with respect to the bigger world. And there was a tension going on at the time of Jesus between these two understandings for the Jewish people. What were they to turn inward, or were they to turn outward? And Jesus himself seemed to be somewhat agnostic about the whole thing. During his ministry, he was a bit reticent to deal with non-Jews. He seemed to be more naturally inward-looking, trying to reform his own faith tradition. Seemed to be someone more interested in reforming his own faith tradition than turning his people outward to face the non-Jewish world around them. And yet, 20 years later, Paul is writing his letter to the Galatians. And the primary issue at hand is what to do with these Gentiles. That means you and me. Because we're the Gentiles, right? Because for reasons that not everyone fully understood, and we still don't really fully understand today, Gentiles, that is, non-Jews, were flocking to this new faith, to this new interpretation of Judaism, built around Jesus, the Messiah of the Jews. And in some ways, this made no sense at all. Why would Gentiles, non-Jews, flock to a Jewish sect? Why would non-Jews rush to a Jewish society, a Jewish Messiah? Why would non-Jews rush to a Jewish Messiah? And the earliest church was confronted with all these Gentiles showing up, and it demanded an answer to the question that had been in a debate for two centuries in Judaism. What orientation to the non-Jews are we to take as Jewish followers of Jesus? And if Gentiles have no part in God's final plans for salvation, then following Jesus Christ would naturally require someone to convert to Judaism, to become part of an expanded Jewish people. That was the understanding. That would be the only solution. But if Gentiles have a part to play in God's final plan, then converting to Judaism would not be needed to follow Jesus. Gentiles would have their own connection to the Lord, distinct from anything directly related to Judaism. And a lot of this Jewish concern revolved around the law, more accurately, the Torah. We have heard the Torah used at times in church. The injunctions of God, they're found in the first five books of Moses in the Old Testament, or what in the Jewish tradition today they call the Tanakh. And Torah is a kind of tricky word to translate. It kind of means law. We can translate Torah as the law of God. The Torah of God means the law of God. But it also means advice. It means good counsel, wise guidance, good instruction, sober recommendation. So Torah was partly a demand, like law can be, but it was partly a warning, like any sober recommendation is, and it was also kindly wise advice, all rolled into one. Sort of like the posted speed on the road. You know, as you're driving along and there's a curb, a bend in the road, and there's a new sign on the side giving you a new speed limit to follow. On the one hand, that posted speed is now the new legal speed limit for that part of the road. That's what you're supposed to travel, no faster than that. And that's the law part. But the speed sign on the curve is also a warning based on how the road at this point was designed, how much speed this road was designed for. It was a sober recommendation to you as you're driving through the curve. The sign is also wise advice about what is reasonably possible driving through the curve. Put all three together and you get Torah. What do we Jews do if we welcome Gentiles as fellow worshipers and followers and disciples of Jesus? What do we do with Torah? What do we do with it? It was a question that perplexed those first followers of Jesus, those first Jewish followers of Jesus. If the Gentiles convert to Judaism, then problem solved, right? But if they don't convert, what happens to Torah? What does it mean for God's instruction given to us from Moses? Does it now become worthless to us? What do we ourselves do with this Torah? And remember that Torah is still the critical characteristic of modern Judaism. It's the key foundation of modern Judaism. It's the core feature, as they say, of the Jewish faith today. Keep the ordinance of the law, of the wise counsel of God. If you take that away from people, what is Judaism apart from the Torah? And this is the argument that Paul takes up in Galatians. And there are Christian missionaries out and about in the Eastern Mediterranean area, all the lands surrounding the Eastern Mediterranean, and Galatia is part of that. And remember, all those original missionaries that went out from that explosion, from Jesus' resurrection, they're all Jewish. Because all the first disciples of Jesus were Jewish. And these missionaries were out and about teaching Jewish people in various cities, but also Gentiles who also heard about Jesus and came to the synagogue to hear about him. And some of these missionaries were going out and teaching Gentiles that in order to be part of this new faith, this new revelation of God and Jesus, that they had to become Jewish too. They had to become Jews. They had to convert to Judaism to follow Jesus. They had to keep the Torah of God. The law of God was necessary to follow Christ. And Paul was reminding the Galatians in his letter to them that the Torah of God, the law given to Israel by Moses, was always meant to be a temporary expression of God's will. It was a first iteration, in a sense, of God's ways to human beings, but it wasn't understood to be the final way. Not in the Christian understanding at the time, but not even in Judaism itself. There was always talk in the Old Testament of a new law coming to the people, a new iteration of God's law. As Paul reminds his Jewish audience, and he's speaking to the Jewish people in Galatia, the Jewish part of the community, the Christian community in Galatia, is what he's saying. What I'm saying is that as long as an heir is underage, he is no different from a slave, although he owns the whole estate. The heir is subject to guardians and trustees until the time set by his father. Israel was that underage heir to a vast estate. To all the blessings of our human identity as one made in the image of God. That's what Israel is heir to. But in truth, this underage heir lived under the guardianship of the Torah, of the law of God, to all the injunctions that limited his or her freedom, because he wasn't yet ready for the full freedom of his creation. God had to set up these injunctions, these ordinances, these requirements around the heir to life in order that this heir might stay on what we might call the narrow path. The time of his full freedom had yet to be revealed to Israel by God. Then he would become truly free. And we should not underestimate the challenge of personal freedom in life. People in Western culture today enjoy more personal freedom than at any time in human history. There's probably no culture at live or has ever existed in human history where people, the general people, have had more freedom in choosing for themselves if it is they want to do or become today. And yet polling suggests that people are more prone to anxiety and depression today than ever before. Anxiety and depression have become an epidemic, we might even say a pandemic. You'd think personal freedom would bring more happiness to people. But I think people are actually, were generally more happier 100 years ago than they are today. Even with all the problems of living in 1923, I think there was more true happiness in people's lives then than there is today. We tend to think that we're mature enough to handle freedom in all its full guise. Most of us think we don't need guardrails in life, guardrails that keep us, in a sense, on the straight and narrow. That's what the Torah did for the Jews. The Torah was the guardrails from keeping people from crashing into the ditch. It's like the training wheels that we put on our kids' bikes. We're learning how to ride life, and the Torah is the training wheels given to people. And we want as kids to get those wheels off as fast as possible. And of course, it's not unusual in human society to limit people's freedom. We have lots of laws that do that. We limit freedom on the basis of age. It's pretty common to limit people's freedom on the basis of age because of one's maturity. If we're not fully mature, we're not capable of exercising our full freedom. We don't have the maturity necessarily to make the best decisions. We're often in over our head on matters. That's why we don't allow children to drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes. Yes, it happens, but we don't condone it as a culture. We don't let youth under the age of 16 get driver's licenses. And we don't let youth go down and gamble in casinos or engage in a host of other activities that requires a certain level of maturity. But I think our culture today is pretty naive when it comes to the age of majority of a host of activities, because just because you turn 18 doesn't necessarily mean you're ready to exercise your full freedom. Those of us who have gotten older understand this. Many cultures around the world have restrictions up to the age of 25, sometimes 30. In the United States, you can't be president until you're 35 years old. One of the problems when we exercise our freedom prematurely is that we become slaves to the elemental spiritual forces of life. Our freedom turns into bondage. When I was 17, I was pumping gas in a full-service Shell station in Burlington. I was working with a friend of mine who I went to school with. And he started smoking cigarettes. He liked the buzz he got from smoking. I guess when you first start off smoking, it's not uncommon to get a kind of buzz. And he thought it was kind of cool to go around smoking. But I remember a year later him saying to me that the buzz had long ago disappeared. And any novelty of smoking had long since gone into the rearview mirror of his life. And all he was left with was an addiction. That's all he had left was an addiction and an expensive habit. And he was lamenting ever starting up smoking. See, sometimes we have these limitations put on us for our own benefit. And the Torah of God was an attempt to limit people from coming under the elemental powers at work in life, the physical and spiritual elemental powers. And its success was mixed. It didn't really work that well. In fact, according to Paul, it was only meant to be an interim solution anyway. It was never the intention that it be the final resolution to the problem of freedom. Paul goes on to say in Galatians 4, but when the set time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law, that we might receive adoption as children. What Paul was getting at is that a new approach, a new program of God was coming into existence. A new iteration of God's way in life was coming into existence. It was ushered in by the coming in of the Son of God. As Paul says, born of a woman, born under the law, someone who is completely part of the human experience. One from God, but one fully human and fully confronted by the challenge of human freedom. And the solution that God has offered us in Jesus was that the same Spirit that lived in him could be sent into our hearts. That's the offer given to us in Christ. That's what it means to be adopted as a child of God, to have the same Spirit that was in Jesus come into us. The Spirit that was fully awake in Jesus can now be fully awake in us. The Spirit that calls out through Jesus, Abba, Father, can now be the same Spirit that comes into us and calls out through us, Abba, Father. Paul says, because you are his children, God sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, the Spirit who calls out, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but God's child, and since you are his child, God has made you also an heir. As God's heir, you have claim to the full freedom of what it means to be made in the likeness of God. A freedom that can set you free from all anger and hostility, hatred, angst, anxiety, depression. you can be set free. Because for Paul, and this is someone who is himself Jewish, understand this, for Paul, being a Jew was only ever meant to be an interim step to becoming a child of God. Only a chapter early in Galatians, he's talking about what it means to be baptized into Christ, about the new creation of Christ. And he says in that moment, in discussion around baptism, that in baptism, there is no longer male nor female, Gentile or Jew, rich or poor. A new human being is being created. Our lives, all our lives, are at best interim steps. Whatever you are today, whatever makes you up, however you understand yourself, whatever identity you have, it's always an interim step towards something in the future. It's always an interim step on the way. God has given us the Spirit of the Son. And what we're asked to do today is to let this Spirit enter into our hearts, so that we too can join with all creation in crying, Abba, Father, to the Creator of all things. You know, as Christians, we celebrate the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem at this time, the birth of the Messiah, the birth of the Prince of Peace, the birth of the Son of God. We have beautiful carols. We sang some of them today. We've been singing them for the last 5 or 6 weeks now. They're so beautiful. The aura in the church today with the candles, I think it's so lovely. Everything's so lovely and peaceful. But baby Jesus has come to change everything. Babies tend to do that. They tend to upset the status quo. For those of you who are parents, or you know how your life was radically changed with the birth of your first child. And then your family was changed again as other children were born into it. That's what babies do. Baby Jesus has come to change more than his own family, though. He's going to change the world. He's going to change the world order. He's going to upset a lot of things. He's going to change his own people. He's going to change what it means to be a Jew, to be Jewish. He's going to change people's relationship with the Torah. He's going to change the makeup of God's people. Baby Jesus is going to remake human identity. That's what Paul's talking about today. That's what he's talking about in Galatians. He's going to remake your identity if you let him. He's going to take your life and breathe his Spirit into it if you let him. He's going to make you into a new creation. He's going to turn you into a life-giving spirit, a vehicle of God's perfect love, an instrument of God's perfect grace and goodness. You will now belong to the whole human race. And those particular parochial identities, all of them, they just disappear. If you let them.